All right, we should finish up this chapter today. We got up to 20. I did finish 19, right? Yeah, I thought I did. In 20, notice that we're looking at both of the circuits. Well, there's really three circuits when you include the cardiac circuit, but the two large circuits that we've already studied, the pulmonary circuit and the systemic circuit. And they're fundamentally different when it comes to the respiratory system, because the pulmonary circuit is about loading the blood with oxygen and removing the CO2 therefrom, whereas the systemic circuit is about delivering that oxygen to the other tissues, the rest of the body, and picking up the waste CO2 that those cells have been producing since the blood has been there the last time. Why are they producing CO2? Cellular respiration. And where does the CO2 come from? Right. From the fuel, glucose or any other fuel that's used, that the carbon in carbon dioxide is just one of the several carbons that were in that fuel originally that the cell used for energy. We talked last time about partial pressures. So any given gas within a mixture exerts a partial pressure, which is equal to its contribution to the total pressure. The total pressure is exerted by the entire mixture, and whatever fraction a constituent is of that total, the partial pressure is just the total pressure times that fraction. And the partial pressure is the only thing that matters, not the total pressure, because all gradients for different types of things are independent. So the only thing that drives the diffusion of oxygen in either direction across a membrane is the partial pressure for oxygen only, and similarly for CO2. And that's why we have listed here PO2 and PCO2 in different places. PO2 simply means the partial pressure of oxygen at that place. And the normal situation is that blood in the pulmonary circuit being pumped through this blue thing, which is what? This is the pulmonary circuit. What is that blue thing? Pulmonary arteries, right. Taking blood to the lungs. The normal situation is that that blood has been depleted of some of the oxygen, because it's already been through the systemic circuit and to the heart. Now it's on its way to the lung. So the PO2 in that is about 40 millimeters of mercury. I don't want you to memorize these numbers. The point is that it's lower than it would have been, than it was when it started its trip all the way around the body. When that blood reaches the lungs, and so it's in the capillaries that are surrounding the alveoli, that's when the gradient comes into play, because then the air space in the alveoli and the blood space in the capillary are right next to each other. That short distance is short enough for diffusion to happen. But the air space in the alveoli has its own partial pressure of oxygen. And alveolar air has a PO2 of 104 millimeters of mercury on average, much higher than the 40. Right? And so that is the only reason why oxygen goes into the blood from the lungs, simply because of the direction of that gradient. If you breathed in pure nitrogen, though, it wouldn't kill you like it would do if you breathed in pure CO2, because most of the air is nitrogen, right? We breathe nitrogen all the time. If it were pure nitrogen, though, then the PO2 would be very low. You would have a little bit of oxygen in your lungs from that residual volume that you never get rid of. So it wouldn't be a zero, even if you breathed in pure nitrogen. It would mix with the oxygen that's already in your lung. But it would bring the PO2 in your lung, breathing pure nitrogen, to a level that's even lower than it is in the blood coming back to the lung. And therefore, that would reverse the gradient and your blood would actually be robbed of additional oxygen, which would go into your lung, and you would blow that oxygen off. So there's nothing special about where we are in the body that determines the direction of the diffusion of these gases. It's simply the direction of the gradient. All right. Well, but you're not normally breathing pure nitrogen. You're breathing air. That's why it'll be a PO2 of 104. Well, meanwhile, the PCO2 typically of your lungs in the alveolar space is 40 millimeters of mercury, whereas the blood that's coming back to the lung via the pulmonary arteries is 46. Now, that's not a hell of a big difference, but it's still a difference. So it's not as steep as the gradient for oxygen, but it's in the correct direction for unloading the CO2 from the blood and putting it into the alveolar air. And that's the only reason that happens, because it's going down its own gradient. It doesn't matter what all the other gases are doing. So that ends up oxygenating the blood and taking the carbon dioxide out, or at least a little of it. And so we have coming through this red tube, which is what? What's that represent? Pulmonary veins, correct. Still in the pulmonary circuit. The oxygenated blood now has a PO2 of about 95, PCO2 of about 40. Well, the PO2 actually is higher than that right as the blood is leaving the alveoli, and it gets a little lower on its way back to the heart. Why would that happen? Even though those pulmonary veins are not branching and serving any tissues, right, with blood, they're just bringing blood back to the heart. They're not branching at all. They're converging like veins do. So why would the PO2 go down in that blood? Well, the answer is something I might have actually forgotten to mention this when we were talking about vessels. Big vessels have connected to them smaller vessels, which are called vasa vasora, vasa vasorum, which literally means vessel for a vessel. The large vessels have so much bulk to them that they have to be served with their own blood and use some of the oxygen from that blood. So they depleted a little bit, but still most of it is there for the rest of the body. When it gets to the heart, now it's in the systemic circuit, goes around to the rest of the tissues. So in the capillary bed down here representing all of the various capillary beds in the systemic circuit, the situation is reversed with respect to both gradients. These cells that are right next to the capillaries in this bed need the oxygen. They've used up the oxygen that had already been delivered to them. And why did they use that oxygen? Right. It served as the electron acceptor in cellular respiration. So the oxygen that they had already received has been used. It got turned into water. They need more of it. And so as they use it up, that means the PCO2 in those systemic cells gets low. I mean PO2, sorry. PO2 gets low, and therefore it brings it below the PO2 value of the blood that's right next door. And that means the direction of the gradient is that O2 is going to diffuse from the blood into the cells. But the PCO2 gradient is reversed also with respect to what happened in the other circuit in the lungs. The CO2 has been building up in these cells because they're breaking down more fuels via cellular respiration, and that's what the CO2 comes from. So now the PCO2 in the cells is higher than in the blood, and it diffuses into the blood for another trip back to the heart and then finally to the lungs again. All right, let's go to 21. Look at this graph. Notice on the y-axis we have ambient PO2. Ambient simply means in the surroundings at the moment. So whatever situation you're in. People live at different elevations. And the higher you go, the overall barometric pressure drops. Now, we like to say that there's less oxygen at high altitude. That's not true as a fraction of air. It's just that the entire air mixture gets more rarefied. There's not as much air over it the higher you go up, right? Well, what causes the air pressure at sea level is that gravity is pulling all this air down and it's pressurizing the air right at the surface. The higher you go, the less air you have above you pushing down, so it's not as pressurized. So pressure goes down as altitude goes up. And that means that the gas molecules in that air are going to take up more space. They're going to have a higher volume, right? So that means there's really less air totally in a given volume. There's fewer air molecules in a per liter or whatever, however you want to define the volume, at higher altitude. But it's still exactly the same fractions of the constituents. It's still 20.95% oxygen at high altitude, but the partial pressure is less because 20.95% of a smaller total is a smaller partial pressure. All right? And therefore, there isn't as steep a gradient for bringing that oxygen into the blood from the lungs the higher you go up in elevation, which would mean the lower you are in the graph. Lower on the y-axis means lower PO2, that means higher altitude. So this red one would correspond to mountain living, basically. And that's why if you're not acclimated to it, if you don't live there for a long time to get used to it, you'll be comparatively out of breath without much exertion. Someone who's lived there for a long time has no problem with it because they've physiologically adjusted. The hyperbaric chamber, notice the broken line there, so it would really be way up there. It's a lot steeper than it really looks, actually. If you are in a hyperbaric chamber, which means it's just a pressurized chamber, so the overall barometric pressure is very high, and therefore oxygen still at 20.95% has a very high PO2, that's basically just forcing air into your blood at much faster rate because the gradient is much steeper. Okay, 22. There's four parts to this overall figure. And what it's showing you is that perfusion and ventilation can be matched to each other. If either one of these two things changes, perfusion or ventilation, then the other one can be changed to match the other one to make it as efficient as possible for the lungs to work. What is perfusion? It's the amount of blood flow per gram of tissue. Right. So blood flow and perfusion are similar, but perfusion is blood flow per gram. So perfusion refers to the amount of blood that a given tissue is receiving in a given amount of time. And ventilation refers to how, not just overall breathing, ventilation refers to how much air is being exchanged in a given section of the lung. Because when you breathe overall, it's not equal amount of inflation of all those alveoli. Things can go wrong with the lung, for instance, and one section doesn't open up more as easily if it's damaged by smoking, for instance. You might have a better part of the lung that more easily gets inflated when you inspire than another part. So that means you're going to have increased ventilation on some parts of the lung, decreased ventilation on the other. That's changing the ventilation. Well, it would be wasteful to send a bunch of blood to the parts of the lungs that are not really getting all that much air. Really, what you want to do to make it efficient is to send most of the blood to the parts of the lung that are getting the most ventilation. And so a change in ventilation causes perfusion to be adjusted to meet that. And that can happen in either way. If you have decreased airflow, you know, a part of the lung that's not getting very much air because it's blocked or whatever, it has reduced elasticity, which is basically what emphysema is, then that's going to cause reduced PO2 levels in the blood vessels. That's going to lead to vasoconstriction of pulmonary vessels in that area, which decreases the blood flow, and so perfusion is matched to the ventilation. Just the opposite, if you have increased airflow, elevates the PO2, vasodilation is going to bring more blood to that area, increased blood flow is going to match the ventilation. By the way, notice that vasodilation and vasoconstriction in the lungs happens opposite to how it happens in the rest of the body. If you have low PO2, which would be in the systemic circuit, low PO2 would mean that you're not getting enough blood, right? Because you're using that O2 up. And so what would you want to do if you had low PO2? What would you want to do vasomotorly? Yeah, you would want to vasodilate to bring more blood there. It's just the opposite in the lungs. On the bottom, similar two circles here, except what's happening here is that the other variable is originally changed and the other one matches it by it being adjusted. So you have ventilation adjusted also to changes in perfusion. So it's not just parts of your lung that might undergo age-related changes or whatever. It can be not all of those capillaries are perfectly working either. Some of them might be shut down, and so not all of the lung gets equally perfused. So if you're getting poor perfusion in an area, decreased blood flow, that's going to reduce the PCO2 in the alveoli, constrict the bronchioles, not the blood vessels, the bronchioles, because you're trying to, what you're adjusting here is not the blood flow. The blood flow is changed for whatever cause, and then the adjustment is to change the ventilation. So bronchioles, the air tubes get constricted. That's going to decrease the airflow to match the decreased blood flow. Just the opposite if you have increased blood flow. Bronchial dilation. Another graph to look at. Percentage O2 saturation of hemoglobin. What is hemoglobin, chemically speaking? It's what? Well, there are hemes. There are heme groups. There are four heme groups. But what is it? It's not a polypeptide. It's not a single polypeptide. What about the word protein? That's what I'm looking for. Hemoglobin is a protein. Well, the answer is not always complex. Hemoglobin is a protein, but specifically it is a tetramer, right? Because there are four polypeptides that make it up. Each of those polypeptides gets equipped with a heme in the final version. How many types of polypeptides are there? Two kinds, four overall polypeptides, but there's two alpha globins and two beta globins. And therefore, it's not only a tetramer, it's what? It's a heterotetramer. Heterotetramer because there are two at least different kinds of polypeptides. Tetra because it's four. So anyway, because there are four heme groups on an overall hemoglobin protein, there are five possibilities with respect to it carrying oxygen. It can carry 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4 molecules of oxygen. And so it's not atoms of oxygen, it's an oxygen molecule, an O2, that binds to one of the hemes or not. Those are the five possibilities, though. So, any given individual hemoglobin can be either 0% saturated, 20%, 25%, 50, 75, or 100. Well, this is a smooth curve. You wouldn't see this smooth curve for an individual hemoglobin molecule, but you have trillions of hemoglobin molecules in your blood. So the average at any given time, because not every hemoglobin molecule is going to be at the same saturation level. So overall, blood can have any degree of saturation. Right? Well, the curve that we're looking at here, this sigmoid curve or S-shaped curve, is typical of O2 saturation. And notice that the x-axis is partial pressure of oxygen. So as we go to the right, the partial pressure is higher. What this means is that since the curve is going up to the right, if hemoglobin is exposed to higher partial pressure of oxygen, higher PO2, it will become more saturated. That makes sense, right? The partial pressure of oxygen affects how many oxygens get stuck onto that hemoglobin molecule, and therefore all of the hemoglobin molecules in the overall blood. But it's not a linear relationship. So a change in PO2 by a little amount can have either a little effect, which it would at the alveoli. Notice the partial pressure of oxygen at the alveoli is indicated by this arrow on the right. If you make a slight change in the PO2 right or left, it doesn't change much the Y value of that horizontal part, that plateau part of the curve. But at the systemic tissues where it's about 40, just a small change in O2 partial pressure has a drastic change in this steep part of the curve. We'll also notice that at the systemic tissues, the average right there, which is right on this line, crosses that red line at about 78 or so percent O2 saturation. And that's why the 22% is listed there. That's just the part that's 22% unsaturated, in a sense, at the systemic tissue. So this is when blood makes its way back to the tissues of the body and gets rid of the O2. Well, it doesn't get rid of nearly all of that O2. Like I was saying, when you're holding your breath, you still have a lot of oxygen in your blood. It's bound to hemoglobin, though. That's, you know, it's not usable to your body's tissues until it comes off of the hemoglobin. So it's important that hemoglobin has this shape to it. The hemoglobin dissociation curve, as this is called, has this shape because you need hemoglobin to greedily grab on to oxygen at the lungs, because you want to load it at the lungs, but you need it to be able to reduce that greediness and get rid of oxygen when it gets to the tissues of the body, because that's what the oxygen is for, those tissues of the body. And it has that because of this shape. Well, let's expand on that in 24 now. What we're looking at here is just a single erythrocyte within a capillary that is surrounding a systemic tissue cell. This is respiring tissue is referring to the systemic circuit. Okay? This could be any tissue in the body, really. Point is, those cells are in need of oxygen and they're building up CO2 because of cellular respiration. So the CO2, as you see in the three blue arrows, that enters the blood from the systemic tissues gets carried around in the blood in three different ways. For one, it just dissolves into the liquid portion. Like I said, CO2 dissolves in water. That's what club soda is. Or actually, more specifically, seltzer water, which doesn't have the salt in it. It's just carbonated water. Well, that your blood is partially carbonated, the plasma, because CO2 dissolves directly into the liquid. It's not being carried by anything. It's just part of that liquid. Some other part of the CO2, about a quarter of it, gets attached onto various plasma proteins that have an amino group on them somewhere. And therefore, when the CO2 gets attached to those, we call those carbamino compounds. Carbon dioxide attached to amino groups of proteins. And so that's being carried around in the plasma also. Well, this is reversible, by the way. These carbamino compounds can give up the CO2 if they need to, and it can then be dissolved as a gas or enter an erythrocyte. The bulk, though, 70% or so on average of the CO2 that enters the bloodstream doesn't stay in the plasma, but diffuses into a red blood cell, which you have billions of in your bloodstream. And there we have the familiar reaction that we keep talking about. CO2 reacts with the liquid that is the water that's part of the cytosol of the red blood cell and gets turned into carbonic acid, which then dissociates into bicarbonate ion and proton or hydrogen ion. The CAH, by the way, just stands for carbonic anhydrase, which is an enzyme that catalyzes this reaction to speed it up. Okay. CO2 gets carried by hemoglobin and oxygen, I mean, as well as oxygen, but that's not really being shown here. The point here is that as CO2 gets picked up, O2 needs to be delivered, okay? Now, the CO2 that comes into the red blood cell and undergoes this reaction is going to acidify the interior of this red blood cell, right? Because you have a buildup of hydrogen ions. Well, oxygen that's attached to hemoglobin becomes less securely attached when you acidify the environment. In other words, in the presence of those additional hydrogen ions, oxygen that's already been taking a ride from the lungs on hemoglobin molecules detach from the hemoglobin more easily. They dissociate. And that's what you see here. The hydrogen ions that came from this bicarbonate reaction because of the CO2 now interfere with oxyhemoglobin. That's what HbO2 stands for. Oxyhemoglobin simply means hemoglobin with oxygen on it. And it reduces the strength of the bond between the oxygen and the heme of hemoglobin, and therefore it shifts this to the left in here, and you have HHB, which is hemoglobin without oxygen, and oxygen is freed. So now once oxygen is on its own, then it has a partial pressure. And that partial pressure is higher than it is in the lung, in the systemic cells, and therefore it diffuses into those cells. So the CO2 that's being picked up helps the O2 from being unloaded. I mean, helps them to be unloaded into the same cells that the CO2 came from. Now, the thing I haven't talked about is this antiport here. What is an antiport? First of all, molecularly, what is it? Well, it is a protein, right? Yes, an antiport is an example of a co-transporter. A co-transporter is a protein in a membrane that transports two different kinds of things at the same time through the membrane. An antiport is a specific kind of co-transporter in which one of those two things gets transported in one direction through the membrane while the other one gets transported in the opposite direction. So it swaps one thing for another, an antiporter. And this is called the chloride shift because what gets swapped is chloride ion for bicarbonate ion. The bicarbonate ions would also be building up here in this cell, right, as the carbonic acid dissociates. But it doesn't build up because as the more bicarbonate ion gets added, it gets transported out of the cell into the plasma in exchange for chloride. It exchanges it for chloride because both of them are negatively charged ions, so it doesn't mess up the electrical charge. But it does get rid of the bicarbonate ion, so it doesn't affect the pH. All right? Now, this is what's happening in the systemic circuit. 25 is a nearly identical-looking figure, but everything is reversed because now we're in the pulmonary circuit. This is alveolar air on the left and the blood, once again, on the right. So those three sources of carbon dioxide in the blood now can unload that oxygen into the air of the alveoli because of the partial pressure gradients. But when it comes to getting it from the red blood cell, That's going to shift this entire carbonic acid or bicarbonate reaction to the left. Why does it shift it to the left? I mean, what is it that actually is shifting it to the left here? The fact that you're taking away carbon dioxide, which is on the left side. So, what does Le Chatelier's principle say? If you perturb the system is going to respond in a way that minimizes that disturbance. So if you remove CO2, the system is going to respond by adding CO2 to where you took it away. The only way that can happen is if this reaction occurs to the left. So carbonic acid needs to divide into carbon dioxide and water to replace that carbon dioxide that's being left. But where does the carbonic acid come from? By combining hydrogen ions and bicarbonate ions to make that carbonic acid. All right, so that's going to remove hydrogen ions. To replace those hydrogen ions, they're going to pop off of hemoglobin, HHB, and that's going to make oxygen much more able to bind to hemoglobin. Right? Remember I said that adding hydrogen ions, acidifying the solution, makes O2 dissociate from hemoglobin. Well, just the opposite is true here. You're reducing the acidity, raising the pH because you're removing hydrogen ions, and that makes O2 associate with hemoglobin, which is exactly what you want at the lungs. You want to pick up the oxygen there. You want to get rid of the CO2. You still have a chloride shift, but the shift is now reversed. So the chloride is now sent outward so that you can bring bicarbonate in so that it can react with the hydrogen ions to form the carbonic acid that's going to split into the CO2 that you need to replace what has been removed into the lungs. So the chloride shift is not an active transport mechanism. It's diffusion. It's facilitated diffusion for both of these things. But since the gradients reverse in the two circuits, the shift reverses in the two circuits. The blue line here in both top and bottom graph is the familiar hemoglobin dissociation curve we just looked at a little bit ago with the sigmoid shape. But there are other ones in different colors to show you that the shape of that dissociation curve, or the curve itself, I should say, can be shifted either to the left or the right. It can undergo a left shift or a right shift, depending on primarily two important variables, temperature, as you see on the top, and pH. Temperature and pH matter for various reasons, right? This is one reason that they matter. And what you see here is that for any given PO2, so you're keeping X constant, if you look at one vertical line here, an increase in temperature, which would mean going from the purple to the green to the blue to the red eventually, an increase in temperature means that dissociation curve gets shifted to the right. And when you shift this curve to the right for that given partial pressure of oxygen, that means you are lower on the curve. Because shifting it to the right brings this steepness into play. What that means is that the warmer the body tissue is, and therefore the warmer the hemoglobin is, the more it unloads oxygen, the more it gets rid of its oxygen. Which is nice for us, right? Because the most active tissues, like if you're sprinting, the warmest tissues in your body will be your skeletal muscles, which are exactly the things that need the most oxygen at that moment. That increased temperature interferes with hemoglobin in such a way that it makes it release even more oxygen than it would at a cooler temperature. All right, and then pH, similar situation. Acidification, a decrease in pH, also causes a right shift. And that makes sense, hopefully, physiologically as well. Right? What would acidify blood in a given area in the body? not low carbon dioxide, high carbon dioxide. High carbon dioxide acidifies the blood from the same reaction we've been talking about. Well, where would you have high carbon dioxide? Where there's a lot of aerobic respiration, which means that's the same place where you need a lot of oxygen to be delivered. So acidifying the hemoglobin makes it unload its oxygen right where that oxygen is most needed. That, by the way, that particular right shift in response to acidity is called the Bohr shift. I usually don't like to give you eponyms, but that's one. The Bohr shift is just one of the right shifts specifically due to pH change. Oh, we're done. I thought there was another one. We are right on schedule at the moment, so I don't really see any pressing need to start the new chapter if you want a break. Okay.